So, good evening, everyone. Really great to see you all. I've met most of you, but it's been a while. And nice to meet anyone I haven't met yet. I didn't check the Calgary weather before coming on, so I don't know if you have any signs of spring yet. I hope you will soon. Because it's uplifting to have a few signs of spring at this point. Anyway, happy to be here in this strange way that we've all more or less become used to. we just a week and a half ago reopened our Zendo in Vancouver for the third time. And it was a little discombobulating to remember how we do things in the Zendo, plus still Zooming. So I guess you're starting to do that too, which is good. We're learning how to keep going on and off and on and off, but steady nonetheless. So anyway, periodically at Mountain Rain, we like to offer a Dharma seminar series on one of the chants from our chant books to help people get better acquainted with these ancient texts and to see how they relate to our practice and our everyday lives. I think you do that too in your study sessions. But there's one that we don't chant very often. We chant it at Sesshin, but not so much on a regular basis. But we try not to leave it out because it's a very significant text, an early Soto Zen text. It's called The Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. So you may have encountered it. And when you first encounter it, you're likely to read it or chant it through and go, what was that all about? A silver bowl filled with snow, Baba Wawa, tethered colts and trapped rats, what is all that? So Tim and I kind of waffled back and forth a little bit about whether to tackle this in spaced over 4 months. But I think with a little effort, we can uncover the wisdom and the beauty in this very ancient poem. So, as with most Soto Zen talks about a text, we spent most of the first time giving background. So this poem is believed to have been written by Dongshan Liangjie, who founded the Saodong school of Zen in Tang Dynasty China in the 9th century. And Saodong is Soto in Japanese. Dongshan's disciple, Saoshan, was considered the co-founder along with Dongshan. So the school of Zen came to be called Saodong, taking the first syllable of each of their names. Just in case you ever wondered where the name Soto came from. And Dongshan and Saoshan were the names they acquired once they became abbots of monasteries. The Shan means mountain, so they acquired, as many Zen masters did, the name of the mountain where their monastery was. You could do worse than being named after a mountain. So, just in case you're ever in a Zen trivia contest, now you're prepared for that one. Unlike Dogen Zenji, who brought then this tradition from China to Japan about 500 years after Dongshan lived, Dongshan left no written record of his teachings. Most texts of that era were not recorded until quite a long time, sometimes after the teachers had died. In Dongshan's case, the earliest existing compilation of what are called recorded sayings, dates to 800 years after his lifetime. Though many of the stories are found scattered through koan collections about him. So these stories were used to construct or to compile these records of stories, sayings, teaching poems, and including this one, the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. But this one doesn't appear in any texts until 1119, so that was a long time after Dongshan lived. And the person who first published this text claimed that it had been transmitted from teacher to teacher as a secret oral transmission all those years. Be that as it may, it has been attributed to Dongshan all this time, ever since. And before we look at the poem, I'd just like to tell you a little bit about Dongshan himself. So he lived from 807 to 869, and he was a contemporary of the great Rinzai master, Linchi, or Rinzai. And very little is known about him, about his family background, but there is a story about him in the recorded sayings as a child. When he was reading the Heart Sutra with his tutor, and he came to the words, "No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind." And the young Liangjie was his given name, said, "But I have ears, eyes, a nose, a tongue, and so forth. Why does the sutra say they don't exist?" I think that's a question that quite a few people have asked upon first encounter with the Heart Sutra. What do you mean, my nose doesn't exist, right? But his tutor was so impressed with the boy's probing question that he said, I'm not capable of answering. I'm not capable of being your teacher. So he recommended that he go seek instruction from a Chan or Zen master, which he did. But this little story sort of foreshadows Dongshan's lifelong interest in reconciling what we call the two truths, the absolute and the relative. The absolute, the perspective of what's called emptiness, the universal, the undifferentiated, and the relative, the everyday life, the realm of, or the truth of. They're not two separate realms, they're completely they're one, they merge, right? As our other chant that we chant perhaps more often, merging of difference and unity, or also translated as identity of relative and absolute. From the perspective of the absolute, as we just chanted in the Heart Sutra, all phenomena are empty, or perhaps we could say boundless, having no separate existence, arising and passing away within a vast web of interconnection. Interconnection with all phenomena throughout space and time, so beyond our imagination. From the perspective of the absolute, the everyday world is sometimes referred to as illusory or a dream, which is, I think, both helpful but also not helpful, because we have to live and function in this relative world, which is simultaneously unbounded and absolute. This coffee table in front of me, which you can't see, but you can hear when I bang and tap it, is made of some kind of wood, which was once a living tree, and it's now a hard object, which if I bang into it, it will hurt my shin, because my living body will alert me that I've been damaged. So that's the relative world, right? And we have to make distinctions. We have to make wise distinctions to function in the world. Anyway, going back to young Liangjie, he did go to a Chan temple and took the novice precepts, the first five precepts, and he was fully ordained at the age of 21. And then, as young monks do, they travel. He traveled from one monastery to another, searching for a teacher to train with further. And this question of the relative and the absolute led him to his root teacher, Yunyan. And he studied with Yunyan for some years and then went traveling again. Before he left Yunyan, he asked later on, "If I am asked to describe your reality, your teaching, how should I respond?" And Yunyan paused, and then he said, "Just this is it. Just this is it." And Dongshan didn't really know quite how to respond. He just thought about it. And then Yunyan added, "You are now in charge of this great matter. You must be most thoroughgoing." So Dongshan was still a little puzzled, but he went on his way, and later on, in the mountains, typically they wandered through the mountains, he was wading across a stream, and he looked down and saw his own reflection. And the record says he awakened to the meaning of the previous exchange. And as Zen masters did in those days, he composed a verse. This is his verse. "Don't seek from others, or you'll be far estranged from self. I now go on alone, everywhere I meet it. It now is me, I now am not it. One must understand in this way to merge with suchness." So there's this word, suchness, also thusness. I'm not sure which I like better. I think I say thusness more. It's not a word you're going to find in the English dictionary, I don't think. But it's one that Buddhist scholars have used to translate the Sanskrit word tatata, which is also translated as thusness. We could call it ultimate truth, reality, the source, the unattainable. And it's one of the epithets or the ways of calling the Buddha Tathagata. You've heard that, the Buddha Tathagata, which means thus come one. So awakening to thusness implies direct apprehension of the truth or the reality of in the moment, which includes both relative and absolute. So merging with thusness could be called merging of difference and unity. That the Chinese character used for it in that verse I just read you, Dongshan's verse, can also be read him. So it has a double meaning in that verse, referring both to thusness and to Yunyan, his teacher. So you could read it, "Just don't seek from others, or you'll be far estranged from self. I now go on alone, everywhere I meet him. He is now me, I am now not him." So this is kind of a sweet realization or double realization that even as he leaves his teacher behind, his teacher is boundless and the teachings surround him. His teacher is in the stream he crosses and in the willow trees lining the shore and in the birds in the branches of the willow trees. You can kind of imagine him, you know, standing there in the stream. "It now is me, I am not it." So again, this line kind of prefigures the lines we're going to see in the Jhumara Samadhi poem. "You are not it, but in truth it is you." He sees his reflection and realizes that all conceptions of the self are mutable or fleeting, like images in the water. And yet at the same time, he's completely present, completely interconnected with everything right there. The stream, the spring breeze, the grasses. There he is, a living being in that moment. Sorry. So I wonder, you know, I think we can access that kind of moment more easily when we're outdoors, you know, can't you? Typically when you're out along some running water or in the forest. But sometimes you even can on the sidewalk, right in the midst of a busy, noisy city. Sometimes there's just a moment where you're 100% there, not separate. So Dongshan's teachings about thusness are the core of this text that we're going to look at. So I wanted to give you that background. I hope you have. Were people able to print out the poem ahead of time? That would be nice. You can read along with me. Let's go into the text. First, the title, The Jewel Mirror, we could say is Buddha nature, reflected all around us, you know. Buddha nature that we are is reflected all around us back. Or true being, unbounded by conditioning, unobscured by all those things that obscure our clear vision, right? Basically greed, hatred, delusion, doubt, agitation, dullness, what are classically called the hindrances. When they drop away, then the mirror is clear, right? And we see with our Dharma eye. Maybe that's what Dongshan saw in the stream when he waded across that unobstructed state of clear heart and mind, the jewel mirror. Okay, so let's read the first four lines. The teaching of thusness has been intimately communicated by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it, so keep it well. So of course he's referring to that transmission of this realization of thusness from the Buddha right down to himself and onwards. But it's always clear when we talk about transmission that there's actually nothing transmitted. You know, we go through this whole big ceremony of Dharma transmission with our teacher, and that's part of it. So he says there's actually nothing to be transmitted, but a mutual recognition of just this, right now. In that very first story of those, there are these legendary transmission of the lamp stories, legendary stories of realization being passed from teacher to student. There's the Buddha holding up a flower, and Mahakashapa smiles. That's the first Dharma transmission. No words at all. And then there's that line, now you have it, keep it well. It kind of recalls Yunyan's parting words when Dongshan leaves. You are now in charge of this great matter. You must be thoroughgoing, you know. In the Book of Serenity, collection of koans, case 80, Dongshan says something similar to his own student, Saoshan. After teaching him the Jewel Mirror Samadhi verses, he says, keep it well. Don't let it be cut off. Later, if you meet a true vessel of the Dharma, only then should you pass it on. So somehow, these verses got passed all the way down to us. Now we have it. We'll try and keep it well. So next lines. Filling a silver bowl with snow, hiding a heron in the moonlight, taken as similar, they're not the same. When you mix them, you know where they are. So here he's using these beautiful images to express the absolute and the relative, the universal and the particular. The silver bowl and the moon symbolize the universal, and the awakened mind, and the snow and the white heron are the particularities of the phenomenal world that appear within the universal. So those next two lines describe how an awakened person sees phenomena, able to see distinctions without judgment, just as they are. Taken as similar, they're not the same. When you mix them, you know where they are. So not losing sight of the white bird in the moonlight, but also not being disappointed when it flies away. Not getting stuck in or blinded to the relative or the absolute. That image of the snow and the silver bowl, it alludes to another transmission story from ancient India, where the great sage Nagarjuna presented his student Kanadeva with a silver bowl of water, and then Kanadeva dropped a needle into it. A needle would have been one of the monk's few possessions for mending his robe. So the single needle dropping into this still water of the silver bowl is this image of phenomena arising out of vastness, out of emptiness. Might be, I don't know, do you have varied thrushes out there? They're forest birds, and we only see them in the winter. When they come out, when it snows, then they come out of the forest to the bird feeder. But right around now, they start to sing, and they have this quavering, lonely note, a single quavering note, and it's just like a needle dropping into a silver bowl. Or it might be the cry of a frightened child. You know, looking at those photos of the Ukraine right now, those little children. Piercing cry. And an awakened body and mind responds to that call, responds to the arising naturally and appropriately. Okay, let's look at the next four lines. Checking the time. The meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. Move and you are trapped, miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. So, as we all know, words fall short of the experience in the moment. And yet, we must inquire. The meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. We have to respond, right? In this world. We can't just spend all our time sitting in silence. Move and you are trapped, miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. Do you ever feel like that? I do. When you speak or act impulsively, you get yourself into trouble, right? On the other hand, if you hold back in anxiety and trying to second guess yourself and everybody else, then you fall into paralysis, doubt and vacillation. Right? You can say next time you feel that way, just go miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. See, little phrases from this can kind of be markers for us. I use that one sometimes. Whoops, doubt and vacillation. Not turning away, not grabbing on. How do we meet each moment just as it is? Dongshan says Turning away, next four lines. Turning away and touching are both wrong. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a massive fire. Just to depict it in literary form is to stain it with defilement. Yeah, so that's where, you know, turning away, no. not grabbing on. No. How do we do it? This vast thusness is like a massive fire, he says. As soon as we try and put it into words, we've already stained it, we've already distorted it. And then he goes on, it is bright just as midnight, it doesn't appear at dawn, it acts as a guide for beings, its use removes all pains. So we could substitute just this for it there. Let's read it with just this is bright just at midnight. Just this doesn't appear at dawn. Just this acts as a guide for beings. Just this removes all pain. I was in Sesshin. It wasn't Sesshin. It was a week-long Vipassana retreat. I went to a Vipassana retreat a long time ago just to see what it was like. And it was after a very painful and sad family death in my family, and I had sort of carried a lot in my this terrible pain right there in my, you know, that place, and it just was gripped. It was just like talons in there. It just would not let go. And I, you know, I was about halfway into the retreat, and it just would not let go. And I was doing outdoor kinhin. And this dragonfly thumped onto my chest, and I looked down at it, and it had a mayfly in its jaws. So it proceeded to, I was like looking into its eyes, and you know what dragonfly eyes look like, while it's chomping up the mayfly audibly. And then the wings fall down and it flew away. And that pain was gone. It's like the dragonfly chomped me up. Just this removes all pains. Huh? Acts as a guide for beings. That imagery of light and darkness evokes that other poem, Merging of Difference and Unity. In the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. That's confusing when we first read it, but what it's saying is in the light we can see differences, right? We can see, look, you're all different people. But in the dark, distinctions disappear. Yet even within the light, all these differences are still there, right? The connections are still there. And within the darkness, particularity... Wait a minute, the other way around. See, it's hard to say. Within the darkness, particularity arises, and within the light, there is unity. So he's just expressing this very difficult to express paradoxical reality. It is bright just at midnight. It doesn't appear at dawn. No light without darkness, no life without death, no nirvana without samsara, no enlightenment without delusion. Just this is it. So I was thinking as I was rereading this and thinking about it that haiku is the quintessential poetry of just this is it. You know, just meeting that moment fully. Haiku is kind of this compressed expression of the merging of the meeting of the merging of difference and unity, brought right down to earth, because it's this moment in this season in this particular place experienced through these eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. That's what the best haiku do. I think the great Japanese haiku poet Basho was the one who really made haiku through his practice an expression of this. Whenever he went on his long pilgrimages or when he was staying in his hermit's hut, he made a haiku out of everything. What he saw, what he heard, what he felt. If he was lonely or uncomfortable or sick, he just wrote a haiku about it, right? Just this. Weary from travel, searching for lodging, wisteria flowers. This wandering life, the cuckoo's call deepens my loneliness. The stillness, soaking into the stones, cicada's song. I mean, Japanese cicadas are really loud. And there's a second version of that same one that starts, the loneliness, soaking into the stones, cicada's song. Stillness, it's like somehow there's a stillness in the loneliness and a loneliness in the stillness. His haiku are always kind of self and world, meeting self and world, right? There's a saying I love in the Japanese, comes from the tea ceremony, Ichigo Ichie, which means one meeting, one moment. There will never be another moment, another meeting like this one. So don't miss it, right? Show up. Meet it with your whole being. And then share it with somebody. You know, write a haiku. Tell someone you love, or a stranger. So that's all I'll say for tonight. I would encourage you to read this text aloud. Don't worry about trying to understand it. But maybe just, you know, if there's a line or two, just copy out a line or two that kind of resonate for you. And just hold them with that sort of sense of inquiry to see what they reveal to you. Let them percolate. Let just this surprise you. You might even write a haiku. And if you do, send them to me. Okay, I use up all the time, but if there are a few minutes to spare, and anybody has a thought or a question to share,